So welcome everyone, and thank you for coming this morning. Before I begin, let me again, on behalf of all of us, say thank you to the people who come early, who clean, who set up, who clean the cushions and the bathrooms. It's nice we can just come in and settle in, but I want to certainly acknowledge the people in many ways who contribute to the maintenance of the center here. We are a totally volunteer organization, and we rely on the goodness of members and non-members to maintain it. This is really a community, and this is our home. And so I appreciate the people who take care of it. I also appreciate personally a number of the people in our community who are really just taking care of lots of things these days. I mean, I know there was a half day of mindfulness yesterday, which I heard when I came in today was quite well attended, and everything was quite good. But I realized I didn't even know anything about it. I mean, I think I knew that it was happening. I didn't know who was giving the talks or anything. And so that was quite wonderful for me. It made me happy to know that the community is growing in that way, and there are many more people taking care of things. I know there was a Buddhism or meditation and science a thing earlier in the week, a class on vegetarian cooking. lots of interesting things. Brian is working with his wake-up group for younger people. So again, there's just a lot, and there will be a lot more going on. And it's wonderful that, again, there's so much participation. And over the coming years, I hope more people who have interests and skills and competencies and knowledge in certain areas will feel happy to share them with the wider community. So before I begin the formal talk, I realized I usually used to start up more regularly taking questions. So let me just say, if there's anybody here, and please don't be shy, new or old, who has any questions about what we do here, the practices we did here this morning, or even more important, in your life, in your readings, in your study, in your practice, and your desire to bring the teachings and the practices into your life. To facilitate real healing, transformation. Sometimes it's not clear. The way is not clear. So if anybody has any questions. Yes, sir.
When you bow to the...
And your name is?
Oh, Dean.
Yes, Dean.
Thank you for having me. When you bow to the Buddha, are you worshiping him?
Yeah. So that's a good point. Many of us grew up in traditions where bowing before graven images or idols was a major no-no. So that's a good question, and probably in answering it, it's probably more subtler than we could imagine. For quite a while after the death of the Buddha in India, there were no representations of him. For a while, he was an historical figure that had not died too many generations ago, so he was still in the popular vernacular of his age. But over time, as people wanted to remember him more, the teachings, there were representations. And the early representations were things like lotuses, or like the Dharma wheel, which is representative of the teaching, footprints, imprints of his foot. and it was really quite interestingly, Buddhism spread quite widespread. We know about it spread in Asia, but it also spread countries like Afghanistan, into Iran, place Pakistan, were strong centers of Buddhism. And it was in Buddhism's going west, and really encountering the Gandhara, the Greek civilization had also been coming east. And it was really the Greeks who were, as anybody goes to museums know, were quite wonderful in their representation of gods and human forms and other types of things. So it was really in the Gandhara, or in that movement of Buddhism out of India, west, and when it came across the Hellenic cultures, that the representations, and if you look at what we call a Gandhara Buddhas, now, they're very unique. As anybody's seen them, you will notice they have mustaches. You know, the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas all have mustaches, and they have long hair. They're quite, it's interesting. I mean, they look like Greeks, so to speak. So again, but over the years, obviously, with the flowering of Buddhism in Asia, there was great artistic unfoldment and Buddha images, frescoes, paintings. I mean, you know, just were everywhere, not just in monasteries, caves, rocks. I mean, it captured the popular imagination and the artistic imagination. But what were they? Right. I mean, obviously, they are not, this is not the Buddha. So to empower that image with some kind of power or something, you know, and therefore it needs to be worshipped or propitiated, like an idol worship, is not the case at all. It is a representation, right? We are human beings. And we like to see, you know, Buddha mind is for most people fairly abstract. You know, I mean, obviously we could have nothing up here. We could have a flower. We could have anything. We have representations of the Buddha because it reminds us, one, of there was a Buddha, an historical being, 2,600 years ago, who, like, was a human being like us, who came to full enlightenment. Right? Full enlightenment means he realized the fullest potential of what it means to be a human being, and all the wonderful capacities of our mind were fully developed in him. Conversely, it means all the narrowness and afflictions and emotional disturbances of the mind were also eradicated. He was a Buddha. So, and Buddhism began with him. So it is a reminder of this connection. Sitting here on Nebraska Avenue in Tampa 2,600 years ago, that the fundamental insights that we are using in our own healing and transformation and practices are connected to this long tradition, 2,600 years, unbroken tradition, going back to the Buddha. But even again, so there's that historical connection, but it also reminds us that each of us, because a beautiful Buddha, and I think this is a beautiful Buddha, we looked for him for quite a while until he came our way. When we look at a well sculpted Buddha or well painted Buddha like this, there is a presence, right? We see a being who is solid, who is whole, who is calm. You know what I mean? There's a certain quality. So just having a Buddha in the you know, meditating with us, so to speak, is helpful. It reminds us, you know, I mean, we could be sitting here and our mind could be, you know, all over the place, or we could be fixated on something. And you look up and you see the Buddha sitting so serenely, right? Continually. He's always sitting. You know, we could sneak in here at 2 a.m. in the morning just to catch him, you know, to see him. And he'd still be there like that. And that's a reminder that our true nature is like that, is always available to us. And there is this intrinsic wisdom and awareness always available to us. Now, that is not to say I just want to say this for full disclosure. What's your name again?
Dean.
So that is not to say, Dean, that over the 2,600 years of Buddhism in Asia, that some peoples, many peoples perhaps, began to invest more in the images than the teachings ever did. Right? And the same way human beings in all various types of religious traditions tend to fixate on religious icons and give them special energy and therefore do things that human beings have done for millenniums and millenniums, right? They propitiate the gods, right? Help me, intervene for me. And, people do that too in kind of popular Buddhism. But what I spoke to you first is really what it's about. I mean, the Buddha was, when people would say to him, when he was alive, are you a god? You know, what are you? And he would always say simply, I am awake. I am awake. That's all. So good. Thank you, Dean. Any other questions? Please don't be shy. Again, please remember that Buddhism was in Asia for, as we said, 2,600 years. So it many symbols that were in cultures were then taken and given new meaning. The lotus is a very popular image in Buddhism. It is a beautiful flower. And if you go to Asia, lotus pools, lotus gardens are very common. You see lots of that everywhere. But in Buddhist temples and everything, they like to have lotus gardens. But the lotus has a unique meaning for Buddhism, besides just that it's a beautiful thing. Because the lotus, we see, when we look in the pond, we see this beautiful flower, right, on the water. What we don't see is what it's rooted in. And what it's rooted in is muck, yuck, mud. That's what it's rooted in. So it has this strange capacity that it is rooted, which means it gets its nourishment from muck, from yucky muck, stuff we don't like to step into. We step in the muck and it squishes and it feels yucky. People don't like it. And yet this beautiful lotus, this beautiful flower is rooted in it, and out of it grows, out of this muck. This muck is transformed into this beautiful flower. So that really is why it's such a meaningful symbol for practice. Because many of us, or most of us, all of us, when we begin our real serious spiritual life, seeking for transformation, seeking to flower, right? Seeking to flower, to really flower as a human being, we begin where? We're in the mud. We're in the muck. That's the truth, where our minds still are filled with afflictive emotions, we're still up and down, we still have all kinds of misperceptions, we're still, all over the place, right? We're in the mud, our mind is still very neurotic, all this stuff, okay? So that's the mud. And if you don't understand the capacity that the mud of human afflictions, the mud of human sufferings, has the potential for transformation and becoming its opposite, right? Again, if you just came across the swamp and the muck you would say, you know, yuck, let me go somewhere else. But if you understand the capacity to grow lotuses in the mud, you go, wonderful, right? Muck is the perfect environment to grow lotuses, right? Okay. Which means it is our misperceptions, it is our suffering, it is our own pain and suffering and misdirection that fuels, that nourishes our desire to awaken and be free, right? So that is why we should never bemoan what has occurred in our life. We should never bemoan, why did this happen to me? Why is this happening to me? We should never get into that place of, oh, I'm so screwed up, I'm so neurotic, I'm such a mess. I could never, become a person of beauty. You know, I could never be happy. I could never really be open-hearted. I could really never be free. We would never say that, because we understand that within the muck, the lotus flower grows. Nowhere else, right? Where do Buddhas come from? They come from people like us. They don't come from anywhere else. They don't come from the sky, right? They don't come from the sky. Buddhas appear from the mud of life. So it's a very powerful metaphor, the lotus in the mud. Good. are there any other questions? Yes.
In the recitation after the walking meditation, mm-hmm. the reference to the superiority complex, the inferiority complex, and the equality complex.
Yeah, what is that?
Exactly.
Yeah, what? Yeah. Usually when we hear that, we go, yeah. So the question is, in the recitation before the Dharma talk, there is the mention of the superiority, inferiority, and equality complex. I would imagine the superiority and the inferiority complex, you understand. That is in our Western psychological vernacular, right? We speak of people who have a superiority complex. They think they're better than everybody else. And then there are those who have inferiority complexes. They think they're worse than everybody. You know, on one side there are people going, I'm better than everybody else, and then there's other people on the other side who are going, I'm worse than everybody else. So they're kind of made for each other, right? I mean, it's kind of a wonderful mirroring, you know, and I guess if they run into each other in life, they could create a quite happy relationship. If there weren't other problems with those complexes. It is the equality complex that throws us, right? Because equality sounds pretty good to us, right? We think that's what it's all about. So this is not the equality of equal rights or justice for all. This is not that equality. And what that verse is talking to is really a key point of Buddhist psychology and understanding is that intrinsically, the sense that human beings have of their selfhood, of their ego, of their, that I'm a me, and this complete identification as a self, as a me, as an ego, is the root in Buddhist psychology, is the root of our suffering. It is what separates us and what causes us to stand outside of human experience and others, and look at life and relate to life from a certain kind of stance. It's not an openness, because there is this blockage with these complexes, this complexity of self. And so what's talked about is, when it says, may I be free of all the complexes, it's really saying, may I be free of all those complexes that self generates, right? because of causes and conditions, your self-made generators, I'm better than everybody else, right? I should be first online, right? I should win the lottery, right? I mean, I should get the raise, right? I shouldn't be caught in traffic, right? Because I'm somehow better than, you know. And then the other side, there are those who go, you know, look, no matter what happens, it's always me, right? Just, I must deserve it, right? I'm always the one last in line. I'm always the one stuck in traffic. I'm always the one that gets passed over. There's something must be just intrinsically wrong with me, right? But then there are the equality, which is the interesting one, which is means, well, I'm as good as you, right? You know, I'm as good as you. I should be, you know, why should you get that? I get that. It's not from a stance of superior, like it should all come to me, but it's sort of like, I'm as worthy as you. But the truth is, we're not, are we? Right? Some people are smarter than us, right? And some people aren't. Some people are more competent than us, and some people aren't, right? Some people have better fortune than us, right? Some don't, right? So, the equality complex, I think, really eliminates all jealousy. You know, it's willing to live in the world and understand that we are not all equal, right? Somebody will win the Oscars, right? I mean, you could debate the worthiness of it, but the bottom line is somebody will win it, won't they, in each category. Because in the world of things as they are, choices are made, right? Somebody may, you know, you go into the supermarket and lots of choices, right? Just because you choose one, it does not mean that the other is necessarily bad. But it also doesn't mean they're all equal, right? Are all cereals equal? No, they're different. Liberate cereals. So it's really a very key point when it says, you know, may we be liberated. It means, can we be liberated from all those views we have of ourself, which cause us so much suffering, right? Because the one who thinks they're better than, you know, everything should come to me. I should always be first. I'm the best. I'm smarter than, handsomer than, you know. And the one who's over on the opposite side, and the one who's always, you know, why not me? Why not me? Why not me? Always jealous and always envious. All those are causes of suffering. None of those people are happy. None of those people are happy. And they're all separate from each other. They're all encased in their complexes of who they think they are and how they think life should be for them. And right? We want to free ourselves of all that. We want to be open and free. So may I be free of all those neurotic complexes of self that I've always identified with. Is that... Yeah, so that's what that's about. Any other questions? Yes. Yes, Evelyn. So that's the question is. I mean, it's really a two-part question. You snuck in the real meaning here. So the first part was, you know, Westerners, we sit in chairs. Is there a purpose in sitting on cushions the way we do? And then you added it, and especially when it is painful. Does that even give us more reason? So again, you know, the Buddhist tradition, the meditative tradition is really coming to us from Asia. And Asia traditionally sitting, well, again, it is true that these were cultures where people did sit more on the ground, you know, just cross-legged or on small little cushions or whatever. You know, so people were more used to sitting on the ground just socially with each other, and meditators, when they sat on the ground, obviously to take a posture like the lotus posture, where your legs and knees are locked in and you have this solid base, right? It's a very solid base and a very a unified kind of posture, because the extremities, the legs and the arms, are all kind of brought together. So it has been traditionally thought that learning to sit, you know, in some sort of lotus posture, in which the body is immovable, quiet, is an aid to quieting and calming the mind. And having grown up in the West, always sitting in chairs, and learning to sit on the floor in a cushion, I can agree that there is something very special on sitting by oneself on the ground in this stable, solid posture, not leaning on anything, upright, is I think quite wonderful. But having said that, that does not mean that one cannot stabilize the mind, calm the mind, and come to full enlightenment not sitting in a chair. I mean not sitting on a cushion. Okay. So this is just a tradition. Okay. But is it essential? No, because the most essential thing in meditation, the meditation has to do with the mind. Right? There is a belief, again, that stabilizing and quieting the body helps quiet the mind. It's a further step. It's a good step toward. But as those of you who are sitting in chairs know, that can also be done in a chair or on a bench or whatever. So as for pain, you know, I think in relationship to learning, if you want to make the transition about just learning, if one, what it's like to sit on the ground in a posture. And again, you will notice that traditionally in India, when you see people sit in lotuses, they or posture meditation, they usually don't have anything underneath them. They usually sit on the ground. Cushions sort of developed as Buddhism spread. So if you go to Chinese Zen temples, you'll find smaller cushions. These larger ones, you tend to find more in the Japanese and Korean tradition. I mean, I don't know why. And again, that is because the cushion gets your butt up. It gets your butt up. When your butt gets up, your knees go down. And you want to have, you know, you don't want to be off balance. You don't want to do any damage to your spine. So the cushion, by getting your butt up and getting your knees down, kind of increases the stability that for most of us, without the cushion, we'd kind of be like that, or our knees would be up, you know. So getting more height underneath it. Again, because we don't grow up sitting on the floor, for most of us, it is an exercise in a certain degree of uncomfortableness, sitting on the ground. And that's just, I would say, at that level, it is just something that we go through, right? Like probably other kinds of physical activities that we may exercise activities or other types of things, that in the short run, before we are fully stretched and whatever, we may find more uncomfortability / a little bit of pain, but over time, right, will decrease. So again, there is a certain degree of uncomfortableness that usually we will encounter if we are wanting to make the transition to sitting on the ground. Again, it should not be excruciating pain. That's not what this is about. Again, speaking from my own experience, again, now, I mean, I began my meditative tradition in a very sort of austere tradition, where everybody was subtly, if not very overtly, encouraged to sit on the ground, on cushions, in the lotus posture. And moving was not allowed. Once you took the posture until the end of the round, at 35, 40 minutes, you were not allowed to move. If you moved, the monitor, this would be this lady over here, would go, "No moving." That would echo through the meditation hall, striking fear into the participants. So to be honest with you, my learning how to meditate and sit in the lotus posture was incredibly excruciatingly painful. I mean, I think I probably spent the first year praying for the bell. Which is a little bit of a distraction, but so I think that was a little extreme. But on the other hand, speaking in favor of that is, you know, I, again, speaking as a good American, we do not do well with discomfort, do we? We don't like to be uncomfortable, right? If it's a little too warm, we want to put the AC down. If it's a little too cool, we want to put it up, right? We pop pills for everything, right? I mean, you know, stomach a little of this, take of that. Headache a little bit of this, take of that. I mean, we do not like discomfort. We like to be comfortable. Again, which is, there's nothing inherently wrong with that. Except for many people, it is obsessive, because our suffering when we are uncomfortable is really quite disturbing to our calmness and well-being, right? In other words, we seem to, as we've acculturated over these past years, decades, we become less and less able to endure any type of discomfort or unpleasantness, and more we look for quick fixes, right? I think that is dangerous. Dangerous just in our own capacity as human beings to be comfortable and adaptable to life. You know, it's often uncomfortable. Has anybody ever noticed that? I don't know, you know, I mean, there are, you know, there's lots of just uncomfortable situations we get into, not just the weather or climate or physical discomforts or, you know, personal discomforts, situations we're in. And we want to learn how to deal with these things by relaxing and opening rather than shutting down, making incredible dramas, or needing an instant fix. You know, what I learned in those early years of my Zen training was, no matter how excruciating it was, and no matter what drama I was making about the damage that I was doing irreparably to my body, or no matter how much begging or mental hatred I directed toward the bellmaster, asking Dean, you know, how many times I invoked the Buddhas to please, you know, could you just move the clock a little bit, you know? When the round ended and I unfolded my legs, everything was immediately okay. And that whole big drama that I had distracted myself with was nothing but my own creation. And that's a good learning. So, as I say, when I look back at those early years, I certainly see it was extreme, because it did border on a little bit of pain for the sake of pain, and it kind of evolved into kind of a macho kind of practice, you know. Everybody was toughing their way through it and more focused on how tough they were than how realized they were, which is backwards. But again, I can see the benefits from having gone through that. So again, in terms of those of you who are learning to sit on the floor, you know, I think there's a lot to learn from discomfort. And meaning, watch your mind. You know, I mean, what are we experiencing? Sensations in our knees, right? That's all. Sensations in our back or neck, I mean, they're not killing us, are they? No. They're uncomfortable sensations in most of the cases. And watch what your mind does with it. The stories it creates, how you become totally focused and obsessive about it. And how, rather than learning how to relax and open, to give it space, we narrow and constrict, which makes it only worse. And we do that with this physical discomfort, but we even as well do it with our emotional and mental discomfort. We're in an uncomfortable situation, there's an uncomfortable interaction or something, and what do? Obsess about it, right? Obsess about it. Rather than relaxing, creating space around it so it can just pass through, we fasten onto it, make it the focus of our attention, and make ourselves miserable. So, please understand, sitting on the cushion, sitting in meditation, there's a lot to be learned on the journey. If you just watch yourself, see how you respond. Right? See the drama that you create. See the emotions that arise. So, it's only for the brave. Any other questions? Good. So, for those of you who have been coming, we are in our 3 months or 4 months theme of clear seeing, the path of Dharma. And over these next months, the teachings that are given here by myself and others will be relating to that theme. And I'm I've begun in the last weeks picking a couple of these mindfulness trainings that Thich Nhat Hanh developed for what he called the Order of Interbeing. I've talked about that in past weeks. That's available, I believe, on the web, these past talks, as well as there's a whole book called Interbeing, the 14 Guidelines for Engaged Buddhism that have these in them, as well as Thich Nhat Hanh's commentaries. A number of weeks ago, I began with the one on that life is available only in the present moment, that it's possible to live happily in the here and now. When I was here last week, I looked at number 4, aware that looking deeply at the nature of suffering can help us develop compassion and find ways out of suffering. And this morning I want to look at number 2. Because when we talk about Dharma, which is the teachings of the Buddha, when we talk about right view and clear seeing, we are saying that if we don't have a map, if we don't have a guidebook, it is very difficult to find our way through life and come to a successful conclusion. Many of us are lost in our conditioning. We're lost in our history, right? We're lost in our emotional stuff. We're lost in our misperceptions about life and ourselves, what we talked about earlier with the complexes. You know, we misperceive things. We run after things, we grasp at things that we think will bring us happiness, and they don't, right? We grasp at things because we're looking for permanence, solidity, but we're grabbing the wrong things. Right? We seek permanence and stability in a universe where there is no permanence and no stability. So we're always misperceiving things. We don't understand cause and effect. We don't know, really, why do things develop? Why am I the way I am? You know, why is he or she the way they are? Why is the world unfolding the way it is? If we don't understand how to look deeply at causes and conditions, we will misperceive. So Dharma, teaching, is giving us a map and a guidebook so we can find our way and we can see clearly, right? We know what to drink. We know the difference between poison and we know the difference between something that is nourishing, right? We know what's good for us and we know what's bad for us. But oftentimes, because of our own conditioning and the culture we live in, that's not clear to us. So fortunately, because there are people like the Buddha and other great masters and teachers in all many traditions, their teachings help point a lot of truths out to us so we don't have to stumble about in the dark. Is that clear? You know, so the light's on, so at least, you know, we can see what's going on. So this is all, this is why we not only practice meditation and mindfulness, but also why we study Dharma, and that's why we're focusing on this. So this is really part of that, this second, and I'll explain how I see it's related. And it reads, aware of the suffering created by attachment to views and wrong perceptions, we are determined. And again, the we is, these are the 14 trainings of people in this order of interbeing, and so they recite them. So that's why they're written this way. So it says, aware of the suffering created by attachment to views and wrong perceptions, we are determined to avoid being narrow-minded and bound to present views. We shall learn and practice non-attachment from views in order to be open to others' insights and experiences. We are aware that the knowledge we presently possess is not changeless, absolute truth. Truth is found in life, and we will observe life within and around us in every moment, ready to learn throughout our life. It's quite wonderful. I hope, I don't know if you're as deeply moved by this. So even though Buddhism is filled with teachings, right? And even though, you know, this period we are studying the Dharma, the teachings of the Buddha, again, and you probably heard me say it before, the Buddha did not discover these truths by thinking about it. He came to his enlightenment because he deeply observed through the process of meditation and deep looking, he deeply looked at life as it is. Not as it appeared, he looked deeply and he saw that things that he thought were true, things that he thought believed would be the source of undying happiness and to him were not that. But he saw that only because he was willing to put aside all his beliefs and perceptions about life and look at life itself as it is. Is that clear? Please understand that that means that every one of us has that capacity. You do not have to be a philosophy major, a comparative religion major. You don't have to be a meditation wizard. We use those as excuses. All we need to do is put aside all our usual ways of perceiving and thinking about, put it all aside, and using a certain kind of methodology, look at life. Look at one's own life. If the Buddha's Dharma, if the teachings are true, then they have to accord with life. Right? The Buddha's teaching is not theology. This is important to understand. It's not just something, it's not a belief system that you have to adopt blindly. From the time of the Buddha until today, all the teachers say, I teach Dharma is the truth of reality, the way things are. And if that's really true, you know, we can doubt them, then we should be able to see it, right? It's not mystical, it's not metaphysical. So, this last line, truth is found in life. What is life? This is life. Yeah. That which you're doing every day, waking up, showering, eating, going to work, having relationships, you know, this is your life. This is life. If the truths of Dharma, of Buddhism are true, you should see them in your life. You should have seen them, if you reflect deeply, operating throughout your life and see them operating now. If not, they're not true. Aware of the suffering created by attachment to views and wrong perceptions. So he begins with that if we don't do that, if we are attached to our views just because why? Because they're my views. What better reason? Right? I mean, can you think of a better reason for being attached to it other than it's mine? This is the way I see things. This is the way I remember things. Right? And this delusion and the suffering it creates works in a relationship of two people and is as significant in international relations between countries, right? People are attached to their views. I have the truth. I know what you're thinking, right? You know, I used to be a therapist in my prior incarnation. You know, 30 years I listened to people, right? In deep suffering, unwilling to let go of their views, of their view of reality, of who's right, who's wrong, who did what first, what really happened back then. I know, you know. You know, even though it was just so overtly causing them suffering, they would not let go of their views. They were attached to their view. A view is just a view, right? You know, I'm over here, I have a certain view of the hall. I go back there, I'll have another view. Which is the right view, which is the wrong view? They're just views. You know, if I could be up there, I'd have another view. If I laid on the floor, I'd have another view. Right? If I covered one eye, I'd have another view. If I put on purple sunglasses, you know, shaded, I'd have another view. Right? They're just views. I mean, this is deep. This is the source of so much. So please be aware that the suffering that is created by attachment to views, not by views. Right? The problem isn't views, the problem is what? Attachment to views, right? Right? I mean, if I want to stand over here and I like the view of the meditation hall from here, that's okay, right? Somebody else says, I like the view back there, Angie's up there in the whatever that is up there. She says, well, I think this is a lovely, you know, this is, you know, that's fine, right? But once we start arguing which is the better view, which is the right view, which is the correct view, or once, you know, Angie orders me upstairs and says, you know, you got to be up here and see it the way I see it, you know what that road's like. And everybody in here has walked it. Some of you might have walked it already this morning. So we have to be aware. We have to, you know, this is a, you know, that this contesting of views, this attachment to views, this arguing about views and perceptions is the source of suffering. It is not the path out of suffering. I mean, is anybody going to say here, no, attachment to views, arguing views until the end, forcing the other person to see your views, this is the path of happiness and well-being. I mean, is anybody, I mean, no one's teaching that, is it? Are they? And yet, we live by it. So therefore, he says, we are determined to avoid being narrow-minded. We want to be broad-minded. Right? You know, says, yeah. Many different views in this hall. Many different views on life. Many different views on a situation. Yeah, my view of what happened was this. I'm broad-minded. Right? Rather than when somebody goes, no, I didn't see it that way, I saw it like this. Rather than our first response being, what? How dare they? Or I can't believe this, you know, they're such idiots or deluded or, you know, they're so egocentric, why can't they be more like me? You know. Right? I'm broad-minded. I go, oh, that's interesting. Tell me about your view. You know? Wow. You know? I thought that the view I had was the view, but Angie's up there saying, no, Fred, let me tell you what it looks like from here. And rather than arguing, I go, well, let me go up and take a look. That's interesting. Right? I wonder what that view is like. You know, it could be it is a nicer view of the hall than the one down here, right? Or it may not be. I may prefer the view from the front, you know, from here. But it's not something to fight about, argue about. So we want to be broad-minded and not bound to views. You know, they should enshrine this in the Congress. You know, in the state legislature. Right? I mean, what a different system it would be. People were not bound by their views and were interested, curious in other people's views. Right? How simple. You know, mutual respect. Understanding that none of us has the truths. None of us has truth in a view. Right? We shall learn and practice non-attachment from views in order to be open to others' insights and experiences. That's why we're doing it. Right? Now let me ask everybody here a selfish question. If you were in a relationship with anybody, I don't just mean intimate relationship, with family members, with work colleagues, with anybody, you know, all those are relationships. Would you like to be in a relationship with somebody who is open to your insights and experiences? Who would like to be in that kind of relationship? Of course. What's the problem? We know for us that's happiness. That's we'd like that kind of relationship. But don't ask me to give it to somebody else. Right? You know, why should I think about making somebody, why should it ever dawn on me that maybe if somebody's in a relationship with me and if I was open to their insights and experience, I may be nourishing a happy relationship. That never dawns on us, does it? Because we're so what? Attached to our views. We're bound, we're narrow-minded. So, we are embarking on this study of Dharma. Over these months, you know, we have 100 plus people in an intensive who are very intensely looking at this, but we're inviting everybody through these teachings and readings to please be open to this. We are interested in learning other views. Yeah. So in our study of Buddhism, in our study of the Eightfold Path, the Four Noble Truths, the Three Marks of Existence, the Four Mind Turnings, and all these various threes and fours and fives and eights of Buddhism, please understand we are just opening ourselves up to a view about life, right? A view that has been handed down to us for 2,600 years. And that a significant number of fairly intelligent, wise, developed human beings have said, yeah, this is a correct view of how life really is, how things really are. So it is important that we be open to it, that we put aside all our current views to be open. This doesn't mean you have to adapt, is that clear? Because truth is found where? In life, it says. Right? So, it should not be, how does this view match these other views, right? But does this view concur with reality, with life, with experience? Do you see the criteria? And that criteria, if something is true, it is true for whether you're a male or you're a female or you're a Christian or a Jew or a Muslim or a Buddha, you know what I mean? If it's a truth or a believer or a non-believer, if something is a truth, right, then it should be experienced, pretty across the board. Is that clear? Or it's not a truth. So these teachings tend to be truths about life. The Buddha only looked at life. There was nothing theoretical, philosophical in his approach. It was direct experimentation with life. Looking deeply into life, other people's lives, life in general, looking into his own mind, his own sources of suffering that were created by his mind. So again, thoughts, you know, these things. So please have that kind of openness. Again, this is not an openness saying be open, you know, like a cult, you know what I mean? Like, get rid of all your prior beliefs and totally, accept ours. This is not that, for those you are afraid. Mm-mm. No. The invitation is to test. Test it. The Buddha himself said, you know, and you've heard me say, the Buddha was a great quote from the Buddha, where his instructions to his disciples was, and this is quite incredible for someone, you know, who had so many followers and so many people who wanted to follow him, where he said, you know, don't adopt what I am teaching you because you love me. Or simply because you respect me, or simply because you think I'm the Buddha, or you know what I mean? Test it through your own experience, right? Test it through your own experience. Does it make, and he went on, you know, does it test it through your own capacity for logical, analytical thinking? Does it make sense to you, right? Test it through your experience. Has this been my experience in life? When I look at it, you know, it's assessing, it's weighing it. So please do that. The knowledge we presently possess is not changeless, absolute truth. I mean, is anybody here still thinking exactly the same way they did 30 years ago? No. I mean, can you remember things you totally believed in 10, 20, 35 years ago, but now you don't at all? Yeah. That should teach us something. So if we are going to have truths in life that we operate by, that help us and support us. They should be truths that can be tested and proven in reality. You know, recently I read an interview with the Dalai Lama, and somebody was saying, you know, they asked him, you know, I forget, it was something sort of directly about if a fundamental truth of Buddhism was shown by science to be wrong, what would you do? And he would say, I would drop that Buddhist truth if it is not proven. That's very wonderful. You know, for somebody who has the stature of such a honorable position within the Buddhist tradition, to say that if a fundamental tenet of belief of the Buddhist system was shown to be scientifically invalid, you know, what would you do? And he said, well, we'd have to change that Buddhist teaching so it concords with reality. Truth is found in life, and we will observe life within and around us every moment, ready to learn throughout our lives. Kind of what we were doing in meditation today, right? Learning to be open to life. Mindfulness means to be present, to observe what's really happening. What's really happening within me? What's really happening without me? What's happening to these people that I live with, that I pass in the street? What's really going on with them? Ready to learn throughout our whole lives. We don't have to close down. We don't have to become fossilized as we age. We can become more and more open to life, willing to learn throughout our lives. Good. So that's the second of these 14 mindfulness trainings. And we'll stop here.